Hello, it is Wednesday, the 22nd of July. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon was fined 10 million Korean won, or about $7,000 US, after a district court found him guilty of violating the Political Funds Act. If the ruling is upheld by higher courts, Oh will be removed from office. More on that shortly. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we discuss the ongoing dispute between Washington and Seoul over last year's consumer data leaks at Coupang, also known as the Amazon of South Korea. Plus, in our weekly Korea Book Club, we review Orange and the Bread Knife, a story about a very frustrating woman. Korea 24 starts now. Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon has been fined 10 million won for violating the Political Funds Act ahead of the 2021 by-election. In the event the sentence is finalized at higher courts, the potential presidential contender will lose his post. Oh says he will continue the legal battle in the appellate court. For more on the ruling and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-young. Hello, In-young.
Hello, Andrew.
The ruling was closely watched, given that Oh is Seoul's first five-term mayor and a major presidential hopeful. Can you tell us about the key findings of the verdict?
Sure. Besides the 10 million won fine, the Seoul Central District Court also ordered Oh to forfeit 21 million won. The court found that Oh received the results of opinion polls from political broker Myung Tae-kyun and had a supporter cover the costs, which is illegal under the Political Funds Act. Let's listen to what the presiding judge had to say.
이 사건에서 부정수수된 정치자금, 즉 피고인이 김한정으로부터
In this case, the amount of political funds illicitly received, specifically the cost of public opinion polls that the defendant had Kim An-jung pay on his behalf, stands at 21 million won, a sum that is by no means insignificant. The offense is particularly serious in nature because it involved a deliberate attempt to conceal the commissioning of the polls and the payment process with the aim of publishing and reporting on candidate commission polls, a practice prohibited under the Public Official Election Act.
The court ruled that Oh commissioned opinion polls from Myung before the 2021 Seoul mayoral by-election primary and that his longtime supporter Kim Han-jung paid 21 million won on his behalf, rejecting Oh's claim that he had not requested the surveys. Kim was fined 5 million won, and former Seoul Deputy Mayor Kang Cheol-eun, who was found to have acted as a go-between for Oh and Myung, was fined 3 million won. If the ruling is upheld after all appeals are exhausted, Oh will lose his position as mayor under the Public Official Election Act, which disqualifies elected officials from office if they are convicted of political fund violations, resulting in fines of 1 million won or more. After the ruling, Oh apologized for causing concern, but said he will appeal, arguing that the verdict was based on indirect evidence and biased testimony from Myung.
In international news, oil tankers are altering their routes in the Red Sea following a declared maritime blockade on Saudi Arabia by the Iran-backed Houthi militia in Yemen. This comes as shipping is already severely disrupted in the Strait of Hormuz. In-young, can you tell us more about the latest developments and how these mounting disruptions could impact global shipping and energy routes?
Sure. Yemen's Houthi group claimed on Tuesday local time that six ships had turned back within 24 hours after receiving warnings as part of its blockade on Saudi shipping. According to international vessel tracking sites, two oil tankers loaded with Saudi crude bound for China and India made U-turns in the Red Sea and headed instead toward the Suez Canal. If the Red Sea gateway, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, is closed, delivering Saudi crude to East Asia will require a much longer detour through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean Sea and around Africa via the Cape of Good Hope. The Wall Street Journal estimates that simultaneous disruptions at Bab el-Mandeb and the Strait of Hormuz could threaten 25% of the global crude oil supply, and that shipping traffic will also plunge to half its current level if the Houthi blockade fully materializes.
And how is South Korea specifically affected by the disruptions?
Since the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, South Korea has relied on the Bab el-Mandeb gateway as an alternative route to purchase Saudi crude loaded from the Red Sea port of Yanbu. More than 80% of the Saudi crude transported to Yanbu is purchased by South Korea, Japan, and other East Asian energy imports. According to Seoul, a total of 15 South Korean tankers have passed through the Red Sea to transport Saudi crude to the country since the Strait of Hormuz was blocked in late February.
In political news, President Lee Jae-myung will visit the U.S., Brazil, Chile, Argentina, and Germany later this week. What can we expect from the trip?
The presidential office said on Wednesday that the president will visit San Francisco on Friday and Saturday and meet with the chief executives of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang, OpenAI, Sam Altman, and Anthropic, Dario Amodei. The president will also attend the gathering dubbed San Francisco AI Summit, which will be joined by the global tech CEOs, as well as the chiefs of Samsung Electronics, SK Group, Hyundai Motor, and Naver. He plans to announce the so-called San Francisco AI Declaration there, which outlines his intent to make South Korea an incomparable player in the global AI ecosystem. After wrapping up his U.S. trip, the president will make a four-day state visit to Brazil from Sunday, then head to Chile and then Argentina. On his return home on August 2nd, he will stop by Germany and meet with Korean residents in Frankfurt.
Moving on, Industry Minister Kim Jong-kwon departed for Washington on Wednesday, amid growing diplomatic tensions with the U.S. over last year's data breach at Coupang. With a packed agenda, his discussions with U.S. officials will be anything but easy. In-kyung, can you tell us what's at stake?
Well, speaking to reporters at Incheon International Airport before his departure, Kim said the main objectives of his visit are to attend the opening ceremony of the South Korea-U.S. Shipbuilding Cooperation Center and hammer out final details for bilateral investment projects. If you remember, South Korea pledged a $350 billion investment package in the U.S. in exchange for Washington lowering tariffs on Korean goods from 25% to 15%. But Kim also said issues involving Coupang are likely to come up during his talks, and that South Korea will explain its position on claims that it discriminates against U.S. companies. He's also expected to address an upcoming decision on a U.S. Section 301 investigation, which could increase tariff pressure on South Korean goods. During his visit set to run through Saturday, Kim will meet with U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, Energy Secretary Chris Wright, and members of Congress.
And that data breach is now turning into a major legal battle on U.S. soil as well. What is the latest on the class action lawsuit in New York?
Plaintiffs and defendants in a New York class action lawsuit against Coupang's U.S. parent company clashed over corporate liability and court jurisdiction. Recent documents from a New York federal court show that Coupang's parent company, Coupang Inc., and its founder and chair Kim Pom asked a judge earlier this month to throw out the lawsuit without a preliminary hearing. Coupang Inc. claimed that the data breach occurred in its South Korean subsidiary, or Coupang Corporation, so it's inappropriate that the case be handled in New York. The plaintiffs called out what they see as double talk. They said Coupang Inc. has been introducing Coupang Corporation as a key subsidiary to investors, but in court it's acting as if it's detached from its subsidiaries. Coupang Inc. holds 100% of Coupang Corporation's shares. Another class action lawsuit has been filed against Coupang in California.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, In-kyung.
Thank you, Andrew.
The data breach at Coupang, which South Korean authorities say has affected 33.7 million users, or more than 60% of the country's population, has spilled over into the world of diplomacy and created friction between Seoul and Washington, with U.S. officials and lawmakers calling Seoul's investigation into the incident unfair and discriminatory. The two sides remain far apart. After the data breach was revealed in November last year, the e-commerce giant sparked strong public outrage and was hit with a record fine of 624.7 billion won, or about $409 million, over privacy violations in June after months of investigations. Meanwhile, Industry Minister Kim Jong-kwon departed for Washington Wednesday, telling reporters that he would address the, quote, misunderstandings surrounding Coupang. To take a closer look at what's at stake regarding the fallout from the Coupang dispute, how it could be addressed, and more, we are joined on the line by retired Professor Kim Byung-ju of the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Thank you for joining us, Professor Kim.
Thank you very much for having me.
Since last year's data breach, Coupang has faced public outrage here in South Korea. The government has levied a hefty fine. It has openly shamed the company. U.S. authorities have in turn criticized the South Korean government's treatment of Coupang, which is listed in New York and whose parent company is based in the U.S. South Korean Industry Minister Kim Jong-gwan struck an optimistic tone on the dispute and relations between the two countries before departing Korea today. Let's listen to what he said.
Regarding Coupang, we believe there is sound logic and sufficient ground supporting our position. There have been some misunderstandings on the U.S. side, which we have consistently sought to clarify. And I believe there is now a certain level of mutual understanding between my counterpart and myself. Misunderstandings can be cleared up, and gaps are to be bridged. I do not believe that the long-standing South Korea-U.S. alliance can be shaken by a single issue like this.
I think it's prudent not to blow this dispute out of proportion. The single dispute is serious, but as the minister points out, it's not like it's the end of the alliance. And the alliance, of course, like all relations, requires constant management. But having said that, Professor Kim, how serious is the Coupang dispute, and what's at the core of the disagreement?
The question of how serious the situation is, the dispute itself is, could be best answered if we have clear idea how serious the United States is side. You know, like those people who are raising issue about Coupang, what they believe, what they see, that determines the level of seriousness of the issue. If they think, you know, Coupang is kind of asking them to say something about it and just to do the company a favor on their side because of different conditions on their side, you know, then it may not be as serious. But if the people who are raising issue here in the United on the side of the United States truly believe this is the case of where American company, pure American company, is being unreasonably abused by the Korean government, if indeed that is their belief, then situation is serious. So, but we don't really know at this point. We have different guesses. So that's why we cannot really clearly answer the question of how serious the dispute case is. And the second point question you're asking here, a second point here is that what's the core of this disagreement? Well, I think there's a Korean government that's trying to kind of implement its law on the one hand, and there is the United States government looking at the process, what's going on. And overall, you know, that is the essence of the process here. But overall seriousness is has been made by kind of like the overall development of the serious situation here has been intensified by the reaction of the company itself. The way we observe here, Coupang, when the law was being implemented, government was taking the action according to the law in terms of data protection and so on. I mean, this is a case that so many of major Korean companies have gone through, and we've seen many companies doing what they're supposed to do according to the law, but reaction to the implementation of this law by Coupang was very different. We remember one of the top executives of Coupang came to Korea and almost protested quite loudly in front of the lawmaker. And in Korea, you know, there are different countries have different corporate cultures. And in Korea, what's expected is when we have this kind of case, usually head of corporation show up in public and apologize for the troubles that they caused. But this time, what we saw from Coupang was one of the top executives from there, American voice, face, what we call, and he showed up and he very, very strongly protested and raised an issue about the way Korean companies, Korean government is handling the issue. And that's something that we have never seen before in Korean corporate culture. And they were doing it, Coupang was doing it, under the justification that this is an American company and the Korean government does not have a power to exercise over it in this certain way, the way it was being handled. So what I'm saying is the overall, the essence of the whole disagreement, whatever it is, has been triggered according to, you know, many people's observation has been triggered by the way the company has been handling the case. Korean government can argue that they've been handling this case just like anything, any other cases of you know, data regulation violation. But we have seen clearly it is the company that has acted very, very differently. Company in question, Coupang, has been acting very differently than the way other Korean companies been handling the case.
So that's one of the reasons why I guess this has become a bigger story than people expected initially. There was at least one more person who was baffled and who probably remains baffled by the situation, who is South Korean ambassador to the United States, Kang Kyung-hwa, who also served as the foreign minister in a previous administration. She said the Coupang dispute had lasted much longer than she had initially anticipated. She told reporters last week the government was continuing to manage the issue and talk to U.S. officials to advance agreements reached by the two countries' leaders during their summit. Why do you think the Coupang dispute has been dragging on for months, as described by the ambassador in Washington?
Well, you know, again, I don't think we have any clear answer, and the only the only way we can find the answer is to find out exactly what has been going on the side of the United States. The thing is, I mean, this Coupang issue itself has been handled not one by one entity, but rather has been discussed and raised by several different players in the United States. So that's why all the more it's very complicated to figure out, you know, how this issue is being played out. But for sure, there is a tall stack of issues sitting on the table between the two governments, United States and Korea here, and ever since last year. For example, how to implement what was agreed in terms of the investment agreement between the two countries when, you know, Korea has committed $350 billion to be invested in the United States as a way to address U.S. concerns of trade relations. And there are a whole bunch of other technical tariff issues, as well as subsidy issues, such as the subsidies to electric cars and so on produced in the United States, Korean cars produced in the United States and so on. That still is being talked about. And between the two governments, there's an issue about how to deal with the digital platform regulation. And two governments disagree on how Korea should undertake its digital platform regulation. And also how, you know, companies should pay for their use of internet and so on. I mean, these kind of issues are sitting on the table, and they're saying Coupang is kind of being played out as one of the obstacles to stand in the way. I mean, even they're saying even issues of beyond the boundary of businesses, such as transfer of wartime command and control of military operation, which is a critical thing that has been discussed between the two countries for decades. And they're saying Coupang issue may be playing, you know, having some certain impact. And the military discussion of the future role of, you know, U.S. troops in the United States, how much Korea is going to increase in terms of paying for the stationing of U.S. troops here. And nuclear submarine, for instance, military submarine that Korea wants to build, nuclear-powered submarines, and United States has to agree on several key points about how to supply its fuels and so on. And they're saying Coupang issue may be a hurdle in terms of producing faster progress in this discussion. And there are other nuclear power generation issues, such as like a further enrichment of uranium fuels and reuse of the spent fuels. They're all saying the Coupang issue may be standing in the way. We don't know exactly to what extent such concern is true indeed. And for me, personally speaking, it's hard to imagine a one entity continuously intervening in the bilateral discussion between the two governments on all these issues, business, regulation, industrial policy, military issues, with one issue of Kupang in mind and continuously saying, you cannot go further on this U.S. government because we have a Kupang issue. I don't believe it's the case, but somehow, the people who are raising concerns here in Korea are arguing that maybe, may not be the case. We're not sure. But the fact is, Ambassador Kang has specifically mentioned that Kupang seems to be standing in the way of many of these issues. So I think we'll just have to closely watch and who's behind this current trouble, who's running the show, and we'll have to wait for the answer in later days, perhaps, with more information.
The data breach here in Korea, domestically at least, that triggered a sweeping government response in South Korea. Police raided the company's Seoul headquarters. Tax authorities launched a special audit. The parliament summoned executives. And last month, a South Korean regulator fined Kupang a record 624.7 billion won, $409 million. The Personal Information Protection Commission's fine for Kupang is the largest levied for a data breach concerning private personal information. Professor Kim, what's your take on the South Korean government's handling of the data breach? What especially ruffled feathers in Washington?
When the Korean government argues that it's handling this case just like any other cases before, we know basically largely it's based on facts because we remember how other cases of such private information violation has been handled before. So largely in the big picture, we do agree what Korean government says is true based on what we know, what we have seen here in Korea. And to that, also, we have to add, looking further into this picture, we have to add that this is extremely democratic governance we have here in Korea, and Korean government sees very high level of accountability to the people, public sentiment, and so on. And when a company, founded by a Korean descendant, and the founder himself has claimed that he's a Korean citizen or Korean person or member of Korean society at the beginning of, foundation of this company, and he was on media a lot and he has been well known. But suddenly, ever since the company's listing in the U.S. stock market in 2021, Korean people noticed the founder is claiming that this is an American company, he's an American citizen, and so on. And it doesn't go down so well, in terms of the way Korean people take it. And Korean government has to be sensitive to that public sentiment. We have a democratic politics here. It's a democratic government. What that means is people's sentiment matters here. And, according to, not necessarily my view, I don't know, but according to the critics of Kupang, believe Kupang had shown very distinct tendency of high-handedness and arrogance in the way they are handling this case. And Korean government has to show its proper, quote-unquote, proper response to this kind of unique way of the company is handling the case. So I think that's probably what we have seen so far, and that's how I perceive the situation up to, so far, up to this point.
Perhaps because Bum Kim has emphasized his American citizenship and the fact that Kupang's parent company is based in the U.S., U.S. lawmakers and investors have repeatedly criticized the probe into Seattle-based Kupang, alleging that South Korea is engaging in discriminatory anti-American regulatory practices. A recent report by the House Judiciary Committee describes South Korea's investigations of U.S. companies, such as Kupang, as coercive, and says Seoul subjected American companies to overly burdensome regulatory requirements and excessive fines and penalties in favor of Korean firms. The committee said Kupang in particular had been a, quote, consistent target of the South Korean government. The South Korean government has disputed those portrayals of the company and its investigations into Kupang. Professor Kim, those are pretty strong words coming from the U.S. Congress. What is Washington's policy goal, in your opinion?
I'm not sure whether there is a Washington policy goal here. We've been hearing voices from Washington. And as I said at the beginning of this program, I am interested in finding out who may be the real driver behind all these things, or is this just a, you know, popping voices in different corners of Washington? And, you know, the outlets like the New York Times and other U.S. media have carried their articles saying that Kupang has been heavily engaged in lobbying and channeling money to politicians. And in that case, these politicians may feel obligated to speak out. And, you know, according to the general belief here in Korea, that is what's happening. So calling this as an American policy, U.S. government policy, seems to be difficult, at least so far. And that's why, as, again, as I said, if there is any organized drive as a policy of U.S. government in raising this issue or not. So we still have to wait and see on this side. But, you know, what's clear is while Kupang is, you know, driving this lobbying campaign, I've been hearing many experts here in Korea saying that, you know, it could have been better if Korean government and Korean entities in Washington could have been engaged in a more proactive campaign, emphasizing the fact that Kupang, when it claims it's American company, you know, just like as New York Times article pointed out, they have to look into how many jobs they create in the United States as an American company, how much tax they pay to U.S. government as an American company. The point here is that Kupang seems to be a company that has been largely, almost entirely built in Korea, making most of its money in Korea. Of course, it has created a lot of jobs here in Korea as well, which is the reason why general public here in Korea believe it's a Korean company. But in the eyes of Korean public, what they see is this Korean company founded in Korea having enlisted, you know, listed in the New York Stock Exchange, suddenly calling itself up as an American company and using its lobbying in Washington to pressure Korean government and Korean regulators. So that's why the picture itself is not so desirable in the eyes of Korean consumers. And it looks like it's a task for the company to resolve here in Korea in addressing this not so positive views that has been generated by their actions so far. I think that's the consensus view here in Korea.
Perhaps because of those conflicting factors and nature of this issue, we have to ask then, how high is Kupang on the priority list for U.S. officials and U.S. politicians?
That is the question we've been asking repeatedly here, right? And if there is a organized or like what they call control tower in Washington, they're saying, oh, we have to resolve Kupang issue before our discussion on nuclear fuel enrichment, nuclear-powered submarines, about the Korea's investment in the United States, you know, the tariff issues, then it is a big concern. But I don't know whether it is the case. I think the question still stands out there, and we need to address that question. And that's why I think experts here in Korea are saying we need more proactive actions by the embassy, Korean embassy in Washington, in reaching out to important people who have been raising this issue about it with with a message about how Koreans view this issue here and how Koreans understand this issue here in Korea and try to address possible misunderstanding on their side. I think those efforts need to be made more aggressively, more proactively, and by doing so, probably we'll figure out, you know, how much of a priority this is on the side of so-called U.S. Trump government.
Mm-hmm. We want to now talk about the lobbying efforts that we've mentioned so far multiple times. Kupang spent a quarter million dollars, that is $250,000, lobbying the White House, the House of Representatives, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, during the second quarter of the year through a firm with close ties to President Trump. That's according to reports unveiled on the U.S. Senate website. Due to the Lobbying Disclosure Act in the United States, the e-commerce company has said that lobbying is a lawful activity in the U.S. and rejected suggestions of wrongdoing. Professor Kim, how common are lobbying practices for companies in the U.S., and what do you think is Coupang's strategy regarding its data breach, which has spiraled, of course, as we've said before, into a diplomatic issue between Seoul and Washington?
If we define lobbying activity, a part of lobbying activity as including, like, contributing political money and so on, that kind of money, that kind of lobbying activity is completely illegal here in Korea by law, at least ever since like 2004 or so, for the last like 20 years. But in the United States, money based on, the lobbying based on, political money contribution is legal. And so they're saying big corporations that can channel a large amount of money to key politicians and so on can influence the policies. So this is a completely different kind of environment, different kind of universe than what we know here in Korea. And companies are actively engaged in that. And we've seen many articles, U.S. media reports saying that indeed Coupang has been doing this all along. So it's not different from what companies have been doing so far. And as we as expected, when companies are engaged in this kind of lobbying activities based on contribution of money to the politicians and so on, they certainly see the results in terms of the actions of politicians. So I guess there is a general consensus once again in our observation that this is what is happening.
Last question, very briefly, Professor Kim. South Korea is trying to resolve this issue, of course, with authorities traveling back and forth, including Minister Kim Jong-un. We also mentioned Ambassador Kang Kyung-hwa between Seoul and Washington. President Lee Jae-myung himself has alluded to this issue. What efforts should Seoul make to resolve this Coupang dispute?
I think, I don't know, not necessarily Korean government, but Korea as a whole, which includes maybe Korea's different associations, different social organizations. I hope we can see, I mean, some of them are being represented in the United States. They have their U.S. offices and so on. I hope they can engage in a proactive campaign with the U.S. media, for instance, trying to explain the situation, the Korean perspective more proactively, and how Koreans see this issue, and trying to share what we in Korea believe is the facts or truth. So addressing the perception in the United States about this case, where they seem to kind of simplistically believe that there is this American company called Coupang unfairly being abused by the Korean government. On top of that simplistic view, I hope Korean entities present in the United States can engage in communication with U.S. media, highlighting the facts. There is much more complexity behind this and how Koreans actually perceive and view this company and the situation overall. I hope I can, many of us here in Korea seem to be hoping that we want to see more of the such actions being undertaken going forward.
Mm-hmm. So one of the key advices from Professor Kim Byung-ju is to engage with the American media a little bit more than the Korean government is doing now. But that's it for today's in-depth news analysis. That was retired Professor Kim Byung-ju of the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Thank you, Professor Kim.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 49.75 points or 0.74% on Wednesday to close at 6,797.7. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 2.25 points or 0.3% to close at 751.09. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Andrew.
What's our first story?
The latest passport power ranking is out. South Korea inches closer to the top spot.
So let's hear it. Where do we stand in the latest passport global ranking?
So the Henley Passport Index's 20th anniversary report, published by global citizenship and residence advisory firm Henley & Partners, released on Tuesday, shows South Korea is one of the most powerful passports in the world in terms of global mobility. We're able to enter 188 countries visa-free or with visa on arrival access. So the country sits runner-up. We trail only Singapore, which has such access to 192 countries. Afghanistan was pit bottom with access to only 22 countries. North Korea, 97th, with access to 35 countries.
The great irony, in a way, is that South Koreans can't go to North Korea, despite having access to almost every other country visa-free. But compared to past rankings, how much progress has South Korea made in terms of going up the list?
So on second place, we're tied with Japan and the United Arab Emirates. Since the index was first compiled in 2006, South Korea's visa-free destinations grew by 73, climbing a relatively higher than Japan, which is tied at runner-up in this year's list with 60 in terms of growth during that time span. However, UAE, also sharing the number two spot, saw its destination jump by 153. The report also examined the link between passport power and the Institute for Economics and Peace's Global Peace Index. A country's level of conflict and peace generally somewhat correlates with its passport strength, but there are, of course, exceptions.
So on the flip side, which country saw a significant dip in the rankings?
The United States once topped the index when the rankings were first made, but it has fallen all the way to 10th with access to 180 countries. However, if you factor in all the countries tied at the higher rankings, the U.S. is now outranked by 36 nations. While passport power isn't entirely determined by a country's peace ranking alone, if you look at the peace index, the United States ranked 134th, Israel at 149th. Both are at war with Iran.
Hoping for peace in the Middle East and, of course, in Ukraine as well. But now let's move on to our next story. What do you have, Dan?
Back here in Korea, a small crocodile was found in a stream in Yeoju, Gyeonggi province, and it turns out to be a very rare species.
Crocs are, of course, not native to Korea, so we have to ask, how was the crocodile found?
So according to Yeoju city officials on Wednesday, fire authorities were dispatched to Soyang Stream on Saturday to capture a crocodile measuring some 80 centimeters long. They were able to bring the animal in alive and unharmed. Other than looking for possible owners of the animal, they also sent photos and videos of the croc to the National Institute of Biological Resources to learn more about the animal.
You mentioned the crocodile was a member of a rare species. Tell us what the experts at the National Institute of Biological Resources said.
So according to the institute, based on the olive brown body, long narrow snout, and a distinctive bony ridge on the back of its head, and a lightly armored back covered in rough rectangular scales, it concluded that this is a Siamese crocodile that can grow up to 4 meters long. Native to Southeast Asia, the mid-sized freshwater croc is listed under Appendix 1 of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, reserved for species facing the highest risk of extinction.
4 meters. That is crazy. What's going to happen to the croc?
So the city initially planned to spend the mandatory 10-day notice period trying to locate the crocodile's owner. But now that we know international commercial trade in wild-caught specimen and their parts is generally prohibited for this particular species, Yeoju City is temporarily housing the crocodile at a local animal shelter and are reportedly reviewing the next steps to take.
Wishing a happy life to our croc friend. But now to our final story. What do you have, Dan?
Midfielder Hwang In-bum, an integral part of South Korea's national football team, highly in demand in various pro leagues around the globe, decides on his next team. It's FC Porto in Portugal's Primeira Liga.
What are the details of the transfer?
So FC Porto announced Tuesday that they signed the 29-year-old midfielder on a 3-year deal with an option for a fourth. FC Porto eagerly paid 4.5 million euros, or some 5.14 million US dollars, to Hwang's former Dutch club Feyenoord to have him join the Portuguese side.
Hwang In-beom was a sought-after player in the market. What makes him so popular?
Looking at his latest feat at the 2026 World Cup, Hwang had a goal and an assist in South Korea's 2-1 come-from-behind win over Czechia in the group stage. He was easily named player of the match for his heroics. After debuting as a pro with the South Korean K-League's Daejeon Hana Citizens FC back in 2015, Hwang has been really diversifying his portfolio, gaining experience while playing all over the world, from Vancouver Whitecaps FC in Major League Soccer in the U.S. to leagues and teams in Russia, Greece, and Serbia, where he won 2 trophies along the way. Suiting up in Portugal means he would be playing in 7 different countries by now.
What can you tell us about Hwang's new team? Is it a strong contender, or is it not?
Well, they are the reigning champions in the Portuguese League, and they've won 31 domestic league titles, the most decorated Portuguese club in international competitions with 7 continental and global trophies. Both the team and Hwang are brimming with pride and excitement. The team clearly has championship DNA with core players intact, and already they have their eyes on the next prize. Hwang says he understands and feels a pressure to deliver, and said he is already ready and eager to give everything in every training session and every game to play a part to help the team with this particular mission.
Good luck to Hwang In-beom, but that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for the Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. Joining us this week, we welcome back our book critic, Faye Leung. Faye, well, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Glad to be back.
So, Faye, what book have you brought us this week?
This week, I've got a brand new book that just came out in English last month. The title is a little bit odd, but it actually perfectly matches the weird fiction vibe of the book. This book is called Orange and the Bread Knife, which is 오렌지와 빵칼 in Korean. The English translation was done by Slim Jung, and the author is called Cheong Ye. This is actually the author's very first book to be translated into English, by the way.
Full disclosure, Faye speaks Korean very well. So, 오렌지와 빵칼, that's the book that we're going to be talking about today. This sounds almost like the name of a band or a quirky song, but let's dive straight into it then. What is this book about?
The short answer is a very, very frustrating woman. That's what the book is about, at least in the beginning. Orange and the Bread Knife is a first-person narrative, so we see the world through the eyes of this timid, by-the-book woman called Yeong-a. She's a kindergarten teacher, but she secretly hates children. She's dating this super sweet guy, but try as she might, she just doesn't love him. And finally, Yeong-a only has one friend, but this friend is completely toxic. She's always trying to change Yeong-a, guilt-tripping her and making her feel bad about herself. But to all these people, Yeong-a never says a word. She just silently accepts it all, even berating herself for not being a better person.
Her life sounds miserable. I want to ask why. Why not just get a new job, break up, or find a new friend?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what I asked myself in the beginning, too. And now you see why I said earlier that this book is frustrating. But the thing with Yeong-a is she's a chronic people pleaser. She's obsessed with the idea that she needs to be a good person. A sweet and loving girlfriend, for example, or someone who's patient and gentle when it comes to children. And so she spends all of her time suppressing her actual true thoughts. Like when she really wanted to just yell at the kindergarten brat who punched her. Or when she wanted to tell her friend to leave her alone for a change.
Obviously, an unsustainable way to live life. Burnout might be one outcome, which I think is actually won't be too terrible, considering what her life is like right now.
You're absolutely right. Yeong-a is so miserable that she goes to see a psychiatrist, hoping that they can help. But instead of helping, they get her to agree to this experimental procedure that would temporarily alter her brain. When Yonga comes out of the procedure, she's transformed into a person who is the polar opposite of what she used to be. All of a sudden, she finds herself not only shouting out all the things that have been pent up this whole time, but also acting completely recklessly too. For the first time in her life, she feels free, and it's so, so liberating. But pretty soon, things start to spiral out of control. And if I say any more now, I will ruin what was, in my opinion, the juiciest parts of Orange and the Bread Knife. So I will leave the rest in the actual book.
I'm actually reminded of the 1997 Jim Carrey film Liar, Liar, in which Jim Carrey's character can't lie and is forced to be honest. But I think being too honest can also have consequences.
For sure.
I must also say that there seems to be an element of social commentary in the book, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's loads. To start off with, one thing I noticed very early on is that even though I was really frustrated by Yonga's somewhat superficial personality, I still found myself relating to Yonga's internal thoughts. She is the type of person who would go for the cheap, factory-made 3,000 won bread rather than the 7,000 won fair trade organic bread. And she would do that just because, you know, the cheaper bread is a better deal. She would, for example, go right on ahead and read a webtoon series because it's interesting, and she likes it, even if the author had a somewhat controversial history. In other words, Yonga is human. She's someone who isn't completely moral, but nor is she completely evil. She's mainly just driven by her own self-interest and personal benefit. And reading about Yonga's choices makes us think about our own. Is it okay to put our own benefits first? Should we become more like Yonga after her brain procedure, or before, when she suppressed her own thoughts and feelings to put other people first?
I think most of us like to imagine we'd always choose the 7,001 ethical, organic, clean bread, but when it's your own wallet on the line, of course, convenience and cost usually win out. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And put it in a broader frame, Yonga's conundrum is actually about the conflict between collective and individual benefit. The fair trade bread, for example, that would have benefited more people, but as you said, at a higher cost to the individual's wallet. So the second half of Orange and the Bread Knife flirts with philosophical ideas of morality and freedom. And without spoiling anything, I can tell you that the ending of the book is wide open. So any reader is free to draw their own conclusions from Yonga's experiences.
There's, of course, nothing like an open-ended book to get you thinking. So tell me, Faye, what conclusions did you draw from Orange and the Bread Knife?
I wonder if it's cheating to say that my thoughts about this book were heavily influenced by the author's notes at the very back. I read these after finishing the novel, and Chung Ye mentioned something really interesting. She talks about how she used to struggle to be honest with herself when she wrote books. She would be overly aware of the reader, and she would try to insert emotions and reactions that she thinks should be there, rather than the ones she actually feels. Sounds familiar, right?
Just like myself and everyone else, and maybe Yonga as well in the book.
Exactly, just like Yonga in the book, and ourselves sometimes. So for Chung Ye, Orange and the Bread Knife is the first time she decided to let it all go and just write something where she was completely honest with herself. Something that wasn't safe, something that contained controversial material, and that some people might very well hate. But here we are, reviewing this book on air. This honest book about a woman putting herself first has done so well that it's been translated into English and is being read by readers around the world. So to circle all the way back to your question, Andrew, about the conclusions I drew from the book, I think that moral debates and social commentary aside, what Orange and the Bread Knife is really about is honesty. It's about honesty and the enormous Herculean effort it takes to be honest with yourself.
a book that we can all relate to. That was book critic Faye Leung reviewing Orange and the Bread Knife, or in Korean, Orange wa Bankal by Chung Ye. Thank you, Faye.
Thank you very much.
And this is where we wrap up today's show. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. As always, thank you for listening. Goodbye.